Hi, my name is Melissa McCarthy, and I feel just delightful about being Conan O'Brien's best friend.
Oh, best friend?
Yeah, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yes, of course. I have to make a few calls very quickly.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Hello there and welcome to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. I am Conan O'Brien. I think that's pretty clear. And yes, I'm always in need of a friend. This podcast is a search to connect with people. I'm having an absolute blast. We've been doing this for a while now, and I just keep having more and more fun. So it's been kind of a revelation. And I am assisted, as always, by my right hand, our sort of producer extraordinaire, Matt Gourley.
You're right. Withered hand.
Yeah, exactly. No, you do a terrific job, Matt. And you are, you know, I didn't realize this when I first met you. I thought, you know, who is this clown? And I think I behaved terribly towards you. And over time, I found that you are the podcast whisperer. You're very well respected and regarded in the podcast space. I still don't take anything back, I said.
No, no.
Because I think it helped you. I think it built your character.
Can you believe it? We're coming up on 3 years.
Is it really almost 3 years?
Yeah.
Wow. It's been fun. It's been just sailing by. And of course, Sonam Avsesian been with us for a long time. She is out right now on maternity leave, rearing her twin babies, Mikey and Charlie. And I saw them recently on a Zoom, and they are adorable. And filling in for Sona is her assistant. I can't believe Sona had an assistant because apparently Sona never did anything. But but what little she did do, you were doing. David Hopping. Thanks for being here, David.
Thank you.
You know what's funny? I was recently, it was just yesterday, someone said that they had one criticism of the podcast. And of course, I was intrigued. And I said, what's that? And the person said, it's not long enough.
Oh.
And I thought, well, that's good. I like that because we're – and I said, well, you always want to leave them in show business wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
The person didn't seem to like that I said that. They're like, no, it really isn't long enough.
Oh.
The interviews need to be longer. I enjoy them, but they stop too soon. And I was trying to explain that I don't want to – you know, I didn't want to do like a 2-hour extravaganza.
Yeah. I've been editing these down to 4 minutes though.
Just oh, okay. Well,
that might be why.
That explains what the problem is. But yeah. I'm always afraid of going too long. But this person was quite adamant that that these should be longer. Hmm. And I'm just going to say no. I'm just going to say I like the – what's our average running time, Matt?
It comes in around 60 minutes without ads. So it can go anywhere from like an hour 5 to hour 10. But then if it's someone like, you know, you're Michael Keaton or something, it might go a little longer or something.
You're Barack Obama.
Who? Yeah.
We actually did a shockingly – I only did – I think – he was prepared to talk to me for an hour. And after, I don't know if you remember, after 11 minutes, I said, I think we got it. Remember that?
Yeah.
And he went, but I have a lot to say that I haven't said to anybody before, and I'd like to tell you now, Conan, things about my personal life. And I said, yeah. We got it. I think we're all good. Gotta go. And I probably could have gone a little longer with him.
Yeah, well, next time.
He keeps asking to come back. But
he won't leave us alone.
He won't.
Was he the person that said that?
He was the one. And then he called me back. The podcast is not long enough. I listened, and it's exactly 7 minutes. You cut me off. That's not really – I don't even think that's a Barack Obama impression, but it gives you the idea. It's that staccato. Mm-hmm. He punches his sentences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I think we're going to keep it. What do you think, Matt? What could be better about the podcast? I'm always trying to get better and grow in every way.
Oh, God. Oh, man. I'm not prepared for this.
No, that just means there's nothing else we can do. It's pretty much perfect.
I tried to think of something. There's not a single thing.
Yeah. Well, that's why I always ask for criticism very quickly on the spot and then move on.
Yeah, that's smart.
Never give anyone time to think about all the things that we could do to make this so much better, because who needs that? David, how are you enjoying the experience of being on the podcast?
It's been fun.
Yeah, you're getting recognized a lot now?
No.
No, of course not. It's a podcast. It's a podcast.
I love to text Sona how much fun it is to be her.
Oh, my God. Sona has so much FOMO. And you kids listening, that's fear of missing out. She can't stand that we're having all this fun. And that she's missing her old life, as happy as she is, having created two human beings. And then we torment her. So we do, David and I keep doing all of Sona's favorite things that she would do with me. Like she loves sushi from this place, Sugarfish. And there's one right next to our podcast studio. And I keep taking David there. And that's one of her favorite things in the world, is eating on my dime. David and I will gorge ourselves on really good Sugarfish sushi. And then we take selfies where I'm just laughing maniacally and you're in the background with some Toro hanging out of your mouth. And then we send to Sona and she flips out.
And then at the end, he could just give me the receipt, but he'll take a picture of the receipt and text it to Sona too.
I text it to Sona to say like, all right, by the way, make sure this receipt gets accounted for. And she's like, David's right there. He could do that.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but we should do a segment where we eat s'mores and watch Friends just to make
her jealous. Yeah. We should do everything Sona would like to do and just to torment her. That would mean alcohol. She likes her white wine. And we should watch, what's that movie about the strippers, the male strippers?
Oh, Magic Mike.
Magic Mike.
Yeah, we should do a Magic Mike binge watch while we drink white wine.
And you have to get high,
I love
too.
This idea.
And get high.
Yes.
And eat tons of In-N-Out Burger.
Oh, my God.
And then just be laughing maniacally and videotaping the whole thing, and then we should send it to Sona.
I love this.
I think that's a great plan.
And just as a night sounds good.
Yeah, let's not even shoot it.
Yeah.
Or let's skip all the other stuff and let's just all go and watch some male strippers.
Let's the three of us go to Vegas, drink wine at the Thunder Down Under strip club and get high.
Yeah, and then just hang out for weeks and weeks with the guys from, what am I revealing? Sounds very strange. Just keep coming back to, how do we hang out with the guys from Thunder Down Under?
It's the first question when you interviewed us. Do you have any connections to Thunder Down Under?
That is
you
the question.
That
is
the question. The today.
Again, I know that I've known you for 3 years, Matt Gourley, but any connections with the fellas in Thunder from Down Under?
I'll ask Barack Obama if he's got any.
I don't know those gentlemen. I've never met those gentlemen. I myself have reached out. Try and inquire. All right. Well, I'm very excited. My guest today is an Emmy award-winning actress who has starred in such movies as Bridesmaids, Ghostbusters, and Can You Ever Forgive Me? Now you can see her in the new film, The Starling, and in the Hulu series, 9 Perfect Strangers. She also co-produced the new Netflix documentary, Bob Ross, Happy Accidents, Betrayal, and Greed. That is a terrific documentary. You've got to check that out. I'm thrilled she's with us today. She is so incredibly talented and nice. Melissa McCarthy, welcome. I was headed out the door today, and my wife said, what are you up to today? And she said it in that way that after nearly 20 years of marriage, what are you up to? That kind of loathing.
Like you were like shaking dice in your hand, ready to go to an alley.
I got a craps game over on 3rd Street. It'd be great if I was known as the guy that's got a rolling craps game that's just moving throughout Los Angeles and lots of sort of scummy celebrities with me.
All in straw hats and like Cuban shirts. I'd be like, yeah.
And you were regularly part of it. And we, whenever we saw police coming, we would just grab our dice and run.
It would not be a hard sell to be like, will you spend time in an alley doing that? I'd be like, yeah. Yes, I would.
You just hear alley. I'm there.
I'm always in an alley.
I want to be in an alley. No, I mentioned to anybody, including my wife, that I'm going to be talking to you today. And I immediately get, oh, my God, I love her. And I'm like, well, what am I? I immediately made it about me.
Way to go.
Which is what I
wonder
do.
Why she looks at you with scorn.
During our wedding vows, she had to say, will you always make it about him? I wrote that part. And she said it.
She said it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
She really wanted in on that.
Yeah. That's what we all dream of, yeah. Hearing those words.
No, you are, I was thrilled that I'd get a chance to talk to you. I've talked to you a couple of times on the TV show, but that's a very different experience because it's 7-minute segment and turnaround and music. And this is really nice because we do have, there are some things I'd love to talk to you about and some points of sort of commonality, I think when it comes to comedy that I wanted to talk to you about. For example, The Groundlings. And that's how I met Lisa Kudrow. We were both in a class where you literally put money in a jar. And we were both just out of college and thinking, what are we doing? We went to college and now we're in a tiny room on La Cienega pretending to hold a disc that isn't there.
Oh, lifted disc, guys. Yeah. It's it's just, if you're ever around anyone that does or did improvise, if you just throw out, anybody want to lift a disc? They'll all get it. It's, you're just pretending to lift a huge disc together.
And, yes.
I remember even at the time I was like, I don't really think there's a disc. I mean, are they seeing a disc? Like, is everybody else like, I see the disc? And I was like, I'm just kind of holding my hand. Like, I was like, how thick is the disc? Like,
yeah.
I asked too many questions. So yes. Like, just lift the disc. I was like, how, like, is it cast iron? Is it balsa wood? Like, these are, they're like, just crouch down and put your hands out and come up at the same time as everyone else. I'm like, you got it.
I ruptured a muscle in my back lifting a disc that wasn't there. Because in the world of improv, the first thing they start teaching you, and you think it's going to be all about being funny and back and forth and creating really funny scenes, and they really drill down on space work, which is they don't have actual props because it's all being improvised, so you have to pretend it's there like a mime.
No matter what my go-to, and I didn't even realize I was doing it, somebody's like, what are you doing? Because almost you're a sea captain out on an island. No matter what it was, I would always do kind of the same thing. And they're like, what?
Like folding something?
I was always wrapping a present. Because I thought it's scattered enough that it keeps me really active and I really am doing it. And then you're doing the corners, but it's confusing enough where people are, and then ripping the tape. You're busy enough where they buy you're doing something.
But I love that you're a doctor. They say a doctor emergency room and you have to save the patient.
Yeah, first just let me wrap this present.
And the guy is flatlining and you're in the corner wrapping a present.
Yeah. It's my anniversary, guys. I've got to get this vase raked up for my husband. Hold on.
Yeah. But you did stand up first, right?
I did. It was the first thing I ever did performance-wise, really. And I was 20 in New York. I think it was the second day I was in New York City and my best friend's like, you're going to do stand-up tonight. I'm like, all right. I think you're just.
Then you're going to fly a fighter plane. Okay.
Okay. Can't be that hard. Other people do it. My process was not, okay, what do I do to have to get rid of it? Well, what does it really take? It was just at 20, you're like, well, how hard can it be? You know, I don't know why I suddenly sound like that. I didn't sound like a grizzled old, I'll go back to sea captain.
Yeah.
But I just didn't, I was like, sure, I guess you just get up there and talk. So I just went in and like went up on stage and I was like, I guess I'm just so weird. I'll tell weird, hopefully funny stories. And I didn't do, especially this was like 1990, maybe 91. I didn't have jokes, which I still always say when people are like, oh, what are your jokes? I'm like, I can't deliver jokes. I don't know how to do that. It's like such a great skill set, but I can't. It's not how my brain works. So I would just tell these long stories and then it went okay, and to which I was shocked, and I kept doing it. And people were like, what's your set? Like, what set are you working on? I was like, I just kind of get up and say stuff. They're like, are you not writing? Like, you're not writing it?
Right.
And then I was like, oh, shit, am I supposed to be writing it? Like, I had no idea of, like, any of the prep. And then I didn't like the combativeness in those stand-up clubs. It seems like it's the same guy. So I'm always like, you've got to have a really busy schedule because every single club I worked, I was like, are you the same guy?
Audience member heckling?
Oh, always somebody, there's always one dude in the audience that like, no matter what mid-sentence, he's like, take your top off. Right. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
I'm like, one, has that ever worked? Where I'm like, I'm compelled. Like, I was like, have you ever seen flesh when you yell, take your top off to a woman ever? I'm like, buddy. Yeah. But what I didn't like was that he was going to keep talking and you had to win. So now instead of talking about my stupid, telling my stupid story, I have to go at this guy. And I can't, it would have been fun if it was just back and forth. That's not what he was there to do. He was there to disrupt. So the only way to get him, and you know, I was just starting out. So that we had like, you've got 4.5 minutes. Like there's not a lot of time. You had to go at this person hard enough that you embarrass them.
And
truly.
And they shut up.
And they shut up. And then I went home being like, well, that guy that was sitting there either alone or with his other friend that also looks miserable, I made him feel even worse. Like I went in to kind of hopefully be funny to people. And instead I was like, I think I really hit a nerve with that guy who already seems a little lost anyway, since he's yelling, take your top off in a crowded room. And I couldn't get away from that. Like every room I worked, except if like, I love like the Duplex in New York. Cause it right. was they had stand up there. It was a gay club and I loved it because no one, not a single man there wanted me to take my top off. And it was just a very welcoming.
I've always done better in gay clubs. They don't want to see me take my top off though.
They were like, put on another sweater.
Please, yeah. More layers, Conan.
What you need are layers.
Yeah, it's interesting because famously in stand-up, and especially in, you're talking about New York. And I think in New York and Boston, the sense I always got, and I have so much respect for stand-up comedians that come from that world, because I think it's just, it's evolution and you've got to fight your way through it. But I think it is so difficult to come through that environment and not be changed by it.
Because it is aggressive. All exterior. Like what you're talking about, you don't get, I mean, my favorite thing when I work is you get what's on the page. And then once we have that,
let's have
like,
some fun.
You know, somebody's like, okay, there you go. And it's those spontaneous moments that you didn't know you were going to say it. The person that you're working with didn't know you were going to say it. Now they respond, you're actually getting a real spontaneous moment.
Right.
And that to me is like, if you can get the camera in the right place and your mouth works, like to me in movies or in whatever, like those are the moments that you're like, because I think you can kind of tell none of that was kind of pre-planned. And so fun too, just selfishly.
You're saying my theory. I have often found, I don't know why it is, but I've had a long career where I've done both. I've done prepared comedy and then there's been ad-libbing. And the prepared comedy can go great, but if you ad-lib or find something in the moment that wasn't there, the audience knows it. And what you get is exponentially greater than the thing that was crafted by some of the funniest writers I've ever met. Why? They just know. Audiences know when it was made in the moment. They know that that's a brand new cookie out of the oven.
I do too. And I think there's a tightrope to it that they're like, oh. They also know that like, holy God, like that just actually worked. And like, he doesn't know it's when it becomes more of like a sporting event or something where you really are like, none of this was planned. I remember the first time I went to see the Groundlings, I just kept looking around and I was like, well, what part's going to be improvised? Cause this isn't like, it's all making sense. It's super crazy funny, but there was this weird excitement to it. And then, I mean, it's like, I almost didn't believe it at first because I did stand up for a very short amount of time, very short, like 6 months. And mm-hmm. I was like, and then I immediately went into acting school because mm-hmm. I said the words, all new performers are like, I probably really should do a one woman show, which is like just nails on a chalkboard to anyone who's probably been doing it. So I started acting class and then I just did drama for the next 7 years. Like I didn't do any like tortured play I did. And I was like, I guess I'm done with comedy. And it wasn't until
that's fascinating to me. I didn't know that. And I can't imagine you. I know that you do both beautifully, but the idea that you decided, I might be leaving comedy is fascinating to me.
I didn't think about doing funny plays. For some reason, I was like, well, now I've switched to acting.
Like it's an either or.
Like it's an either or. And I mean, I didn't get more serious in my life. I was still, you know, like, oh, my friends were weird and we were funny together, I think, or at least we found ourselves to be. But I even remember my teacher once when someone said that I used to do stand up, he's like, I don't see that at all. I can't imagine you doing that. And I was like, well, I don't do it anymore. And then getting to Groundlings really, like, I mean, to me, that was my college.
What I loved was, and as we both know, there's a lot of generosity in stand up, in improv. There's a lot of generosity and working well together. And then there are, you know, improv can sometimes be less generous when they know there's an agent in the audience.
There's that. And also, some people are amazing at, can I swear on this show?
Yeah.
We encourage it.
Add swears later if you don't say them.
Wonderful. Yeah. We're always like certain, we've always said like certain people are really good fuck you improvisers, like Michael McDonald, super funny guy. He would, and it was so good, but it was still, it wasn't being selfish. But when you'd walk in, he was like, oh, your pronounced limp seems marginally better. And he would keep adding stuff to you. So it was actually super fun.
Yeah. Or, he was laying it out there and then you had to make it happen.
Oh my God. Or it's like, he's like, right before, you know, if he thought, if every once in a while, one person runs backstage to make an entrance while it's, you know, before the lights come up, and whoever was coming in, he's like, oh, any moment now, my Dutch cousin is coming. He would just, you know, my Dutch cousin would, don't mention her limp and her lazy eye.
Yeah. And you have
and
to
then you're like,
make all that happen.
Son of a bitch.
How do I do a Dutch accent?
It's like, you know, I was like, I don't even know. It's just, I was like, you know, then you're going to make an ass out of yourself, but it was also so fun. And I don't know why I never thought of it, but there's certain people who are so good at that. Like he would always just set someone up, and like you had a list to fulfill before you, like coming through the door. It was like, you know, it was just, there's something so fun to it. And to just being like, there's something to the yes and world of it, where no matter what someone says,
yes and
you have to go, you can't say like, this book is heavy. And
no, it's
then
not.
You can't. Yeah. It's like, okay, the scene's over.
It's so funny because I've, in my long years, I've done, sometimes found myself in situations where I'm kind of performing with a stand-up, someone who's really good at stand-up, like a very famous stand-up, and then we'll get into an improvisational thing, and I'll notice they keep saying, wait, stop, stop, okay, now listen to me. And I think, what the fuck, you can't do that. And they come from a different world, which is, I've got the microphone, I'm in complete control.
And you have to fight for it. Their whole thing is a fist fight. Like stand-ups to me, I work with Billy Gardell for years and years, who somehow has stayed an absolute sweetheart, even though—
He's a lovely guy.
He's heaven. Billy operates on a totally— and he's so good at stand-up. He has this thing of, he can push, but it never seems like he's trying to tell the audience they don't— it's not that— there's different types of stand-ups. There's some that are like, if you don't get it, it's because you're stupid.
Yes.
I think, which I'm always like, And then there's Billy, who can say, aren't these things stupid, but it's not, I'm better than it. Like he's somehow in on, he's the butt of the joke as much as anybody else is. Well, and there's a beautiful balance to that.
Yes. There is a type of comedy. And again, I'm not into naming names, but if you go to the website, I'll put it out there. there's a type of comedian, and their whole thing is, I am the knower of the truth, and I'm going to tell you what the truth is.
Yeah. I was always like, I think I'm the one that's supposed to fall down the stairs and like rip their pants. That's like, I've never been like, what I want to do is highbrow. Like I don't, and I know some people can, it's not my thing. I always was like, I feel like if I'm the butt in the joke, then I'm doing, at least I'm in the right area. I don't know how to do the other. I start to feel like, well, then I just feel like I'm pretending to be someone, but I'm intrinsically not cool enough to be snarky.
Yeah.
I would be so bad at it. I don't think it's like a great thing for someone who's kind of a nerd.
You had success. You had, you know, you had proven yourself. Then Bridesmaids comes along. And it's this sea change for you, which I thought was really lovely because it was deserved. But, you know, that's a movie I've probably seen 15 times. And I think my wife has seen it 45 times. and whenever we encounter that movie, wherever we find it and whatever we're doing, we stop and we watch until the movie's over. But your character is absurd, but also... And I don't know if I should credit this to your acting training, because I now know that you spent many years, but it's commitment.
I would say almost all parts I've played, for the most part, I really have, like, I love them. Like, I fall in love with who they are. And so I just tried to do the best job of, like, they are funny, but they're funny because, I mean, I think we fall in love with people in the world because of our tics and weirdnesses and eccentricities. Somebody who's like, I love them because they're perfect.
Yeah.
They never say the wrong thing. I'd be so, I think of Ben and I, I'm like, we're so weird. Well, we're so incredibly weird that when I play people, I think sometimes they're like, oh, you're making fun of that type of woman. And I was like, no, that's the woman that fascinates me. That's the woman I can't take my eyes off of, because eccentric people to me are the ones that, like, if you're in a store and there's just somebody that's like, yeah, I'm in all purple. Wait till you see me in the parking lot because my car is purple. That's the one that I'm literally like, I get love goggles. And I'm not making fun of them. I'm literally like, yeah, you are living right, because you don't give a shit what anybody else thinks about you.
Yeah.
You're not hurting anyone. You are just decked out in grape. And that's like, I used to go, there was a huge Big Lots on Western that when that went away, I literally was like, well, I don't know what's going to happen now. I would go two or three times a week. I go to another Big Lots, but it's not the same. It's not as big.
It's not the same as that other Big Lots.
It really isn't. It's not. When the one on Western went, it was really the end of an era. And then Ben always knew. He's like, because I'd come home with like extension cords and like a socket wrench or things that we didn't need. But I was like, well, I don't know. It's kind of cool. But I would go there because something about that store, because it had so many weird frames. The Big Lots is, I think it's most places, but it's almost like an old dime store. There's like two rows of food, I want to say. And then there's like weird specialties. Then they could be like a recliner and Tupper. It's just a weird mishmash of things at a good price. So I would go in there and just push a cart around and watch people because there were such characters in there. And then, you know, it got trickier when I started to get recognized. Yep. I was like, oh no. And I did think about,
you can't spy on people anymore.
No. And I did think, I was like, I'm going to go to Big Lots in a wig. And so, Ben's like, that's the picture that they'll get for sure. Like, that's the
Melissa
one
where McCarthy like, has total breakdown.
Totally. Which I would love. They got me coming out of a 99-cent store once, and which I really should have saved this one. The caption said, said something like, Melissa's frugalness is tearing her family apart. So he had like two big bags of, I think I was getting containers when the kids were going through, like everything was, they were making slime. Like,
sure, yeah.
But yeah, I love that. But I used to go there and just, and I love, because there is a commitment. Those people are like, yeah, this is what it is. This is, I live like this because I want to. So it's like, if I can ever get that into it's a love letter to people that don't give a shit what other people think of them in a good way.
I loved, because you're bringing up Ben. Ben is your husband.
Who I met at the Groundlings.
And you met at the Groundlings. And it was so funny because the first time I saw Bridesmaids, you two have that amazing scene where he's an undercover TSA agent and you're guessing he's an undercover TSA agent and questioning him and wanting to know where his gun is and saying it is in your butt. And he's like, what? And I was watching it, and as just as a fan of great improv, I could tell, yeah, I think some of this is scripted, but also some of this really feels like you two know each other and you two are in a pocket where you're really comfortable and you're both going for it. You're just both going for it and having a good time. And that's one of my favorite scenes in it. And then I love the reveal that, yes, he does have a gun. And you knew it all along when we think your character is just completely on the wrong track.
I know. I was like, oh, that's a great button to that weird. And we did. Kristen and Annie wrote such an amazing script. But it's like, what was great is them and Paul Feig, like when we do it once, they're like, well, we've got that. Like, say what, like, now go. And especially all of those, like Kristen, Annie, we were all, the only exception was Ellie Kemper and Rose. Otherwise, we were all from the Groundlings. Like, we didn't think anybody was going to think that was funny. We're like, well, we're doing this weird thing that we do for free. Well, actually, we pay for it because you have to buy your own wigs and stuff. And we had no idea. It was like, it was funny to us, but we kind of figured, oh my God, we're getting to make this movie, which seemed crazy. But we didn't really know if it was going to connect with anyone, because it's just what we'd been doing in this little tiny theater on Melrose Avenue. And it was so fun because we were so used to each other that they would. Yeah. And there's so many things said.
That's where comedy and music are really the same. They're different forms of the same thing. And I can't describe what that thing is, but they're both.
You do have to be on the beat with someone.
Yeah. You're on the beat and you know your craft and you know your instrument. And then there's complete trust. And those are all a lot of ifs. That's a lot of ifs. But if you can get all those things together, and I think the greatest gift in this life next to, you know, partner and kids, the greatest gift is if you can do something that you would do anyway with your friends for fun. And then someone says, great job. here's your check. You go, what? Why would you pay me? And also, so many of the things that I've done in my life that I have given, that I hear about the most, are things that I never thought anybody would like.
Ben and I have talked about that before. We're like, we would still be making weird, I mean, we still do make weird videos. And so it's like, the fact that it's now our job, and when we're doing something, like, especially if it's like, if I'm in the midst of doing something very strange, I always look at Ben and I'm like, I am being my most professional at this moment.
Yeah.
And he's like, yes, this is what your assigned profession is. And then, you know, I'm in like waiters and in like a gravy river or something. Super weird. But I love when it's like, you know, the odds of it. But yeah, I would have done it. I don't think I ever would have stopped doing it, even if I would have gone a different way with my career and it hadn't worked out.
It's just to me because, and I honestly don't know the answer to this. And so I'm just very curious that you've been on SNL so many times, have been so great at it, and seem like you'd be a natural cast member on SNL. Is that something that you pursued, or did that just seem like it wasn't a possibility?
No, that was like the holy grail. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there's a funny thing going into improv because, and the amount of work that goes in, it's, you know, you were doing, especially when you're a Sunday company, at least at Groundlings, you're doing a new show every week. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just crazy when you're still working two other full-time jobs. You're not getting paid for it. This is all on the side. And really, you're like, you've got two shots. You have, I'm like, one, you've already picked some type of performance. So you've already narrowed your slice of the pie down pretty small. Then you're like, wait a minute, I don't want all acting. I just want this sketch comedy improvising. Mm-hmm. So then you're looking at SNL or Mad TV. So you've literally, like, all these people come together and we've, you know, it's a very bad plan, but I think if you love it, you can't help it.
Did you audition?
No, I did almost every... I rarely, rarely ever took a show off from Groundlings or like a whole run. Right. I did almost every run. I'm like, I'm here. I love it. I'll do every one. They come, usually SNL would always come once a year. Every single time, I was at Groundlings 11 years, every single time where I'm like, I'm going to miss one show, I have to work, or I'm going to go see my folks and I'm going to miss this one show. They're like, SNL came.
Yeah.
Not saying I would have, but I just never, I would have, it would have been amazing. Like it's the whole...
Yeah, but it's interesting how somehow the universe saw to it that you've hosted SNL how many times? Five?
I think six.
Six. Okay.
That's including the 40th. I think it's six with that.
Yeah.
Which is like—
That's insane.
First time I walked through there, you know, there it's the stage is so tiny. You can't believe how— I don't know what I was doing, but I'm sure it was like I was a jerk. But I remember her once, her big swear, she goes, Jesus, Mary and Joseph. And I was like, holy shit, she's through the roof. Like, that was her. So we don't swear. There's no body talk. I mean, I probably say more stuff now, but it's still not. Like, I never really work blue. I think people think because I've sworn a lot in movies, but that was really the character. That
Right, right. Like, you're able to separate.
Yeah.
You have the protection of—
like, I don't walk around like that.
Right. But it's interesting to me that you can have— the level of success that you've had and consistent success, and then—
until today. This is where it all ends.
Well, trust me. This podcast. The second title we almost went with is The Career Stopper. Welcome to Career Stoppers.
Halt, you're here.
Back to the farm for you. No, it's interesting that I just— it doesn't matter what you achieve. In the back of your mind, your parents are there somewhere. They're like those two Muppets, old Muppets in the sitting in the balcony. They're watching, and that's kind of your North Star a little bit.
Like, always.
And did I betray them somehow? Did I?
Yeah, and I'm always like, there's just certain things. I'm like, you don't have to watch that. But Ben, the first time they met Ben was at the Groundlings, and he was doing a scene with Jill Madsen, and they were sitting on the edge of the stage in wetsuits with their feet over. And supposedly, you know, looking out at the audience, but that was the ocean. And the whole thing was— and Ben's like, I think he even tried to like talk to the director and be like, I think we should maybe pull that scene tonight or not. And they're like, no, it's killing. And the whole thing was just them. They were a couple, and just somehow nicely talking back and forth, but the gist of it was that, like, they definitely loved fucking porpoises. And they loved it. And they talked about it.
In a very sweet way.
In a very sweet way. And so Ben was like, this just isn't kind of what I thought I was going to be. This is your parents' first look at me ever.
That's fantastic.
And he was just horrified. And they laugh, but it's like, would they ever to repeat that in front of them? Or, I mean, but he was just dying. And like things I did there, I was like, can you just kind of go to the lobby after this scene? And they're like, no, it's fine. Oh my, you know, like, you certainly said some things. You certainly did that. I was like, oh mom, I'm sorry.
Oh mom. Yeah. I did a show years ago in Chicago, a stage show. And one of the parts of the stage show, and I did it with Robert Smilin and Bob Odenkirk and a bunch of other performers. And we did this sketch that we weren't able to get on Saturday Night Live. It later got on Saturday Night Live. And it was about a nude camp, a nudist camp. And the whole idea was it starts with, I think it started with two people out there. And I think it was Robert Smigel and another performer. Everything strategically covered. They look naked, but because it's a live show, they're holding things that are covering their genitalia. And then the one guy saying, don't worry about it. And he's like, well, it's my first time. You quickly forget that you're naked. It's not a big thing. You get over it. And it's the most natural thing in the world. And then you're just talking about all kinds of stuff. And he was like, really? And he's like, yeah, trust me, it's going to be fine. And then I would enter and I've got a guitar that's covering me. And I enter and I go, hey, Jack. Hey, Bill. This is my friend, Steve. Oh, hey, Steve. Hey, Jack, nice penis. And then, hey, Bill, good penis. And then Bill's like, hey, I like your penis too. And the guy is freaking out the whole time. And then people keep entering and it's all like, hey, you've done some work on your penis. Yeah, yeah, I got a little work done on it. Hey, penis is looking good. How's your penis? Penis is all right. Penis is a little tired today, but, and that's all they did. That was a sketch that always killed. And we did it at the Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago on the North Side. And then I'll never forget the day I get a phone call. My parents said, we want to support you in what you're doing. So we're all coming out. And I'm, so it's my mother, my father, and my five brothers and sisters are all coming out to see your show. And then I'm begging Robert Smigel, can we not do the penis sketch? Can we not do the penis sketch? And he said, what are you talking about? Yeah, we have to do it. It's like the bit gets, you know, and whatever reviewer comes that night. I was begging him and we did it. And I'm dying the whole time. No one ever said a word about it.
Really?
They just were like, oh, great show. But
could you see them in the audience?
No,
that's good.
I willed my eyes. All the blood went out of my eyes just through sheer force of will because, I mean, I don't know if you were raised Catholic. I was raised very Catholic.
Yes, very.
I just, one thing that my people can do is that if something unpleasant is happening, we can will it not to have happened.
Yeah.
And if something unpleasant comes in on the television and you're watching it with your parents, or something sexy or whatever, you can will it not to have happened.
Yes. And just, you know what I was thinking for tomorrow? I just thought and just the perfect timing of just suddenly you're going to just talk over this part.
Yep. Yep.
And then right when it's done without looking, my mom would just be like, so just so you don't remember. And then we cut to the scene. So and I knew she was due because I was like, oh, also the thought of like watching a sexy scene with your parents, like I would die to this day.
I'm picturing your mom in the theater with you when suddenly someone naked walks on screen and she's like, I'm thinking corn tonight. Maybe corn.
You know what your Aunt Marlene said the other day? Oh, God. I brought my parents to an ADR session, which is, you know, if you have to go and like kind of fix some of the, if the audio gets messed up.
You have to go in and talk into a microphone and fix those lines for the movie. Yeah.
That was for the listener. Not Conan, ADR, I mean.
Trust me, you're also helping me because I don't know what ADR is.
And I brought them in because like whenever they're in town, they just kind of, we pal around together and I'm like, I'm going to work. Do you want to come with me? And they're like, sure. So I thought, well, it's ADR. It's fine. We get in there and it was for, I always say it wrong. It's either ID thief or identity theft. Mm-hmm. We went through 7,200 names.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, never
said it. I think it was identity theft.
Okay. I don't think I've ever said it. Even when I was doing press for it, they're like, great job. You keep saying the name wrong. I'm like, okay. But we really did. We went through like 75 versions of it. So it's like they were all swimming in my head to this day. And I brought them in and the director was like, So we got through most of it, and then he got kind of weird, and he's like looking at my parents that are sitting in there watching. They're in the big recording studio, and he's like, we've kind of get wild lines on, I need sex sounds. And I was
oh my God.
Mike, Sand, which also I had never done. And I was like, and he's like, not so much sounds, but I think you said, I said something like break my pelvis. And he's like, there's a rustling on break my pelvis. So we need you to yell that. And I just was like, Mom, Dad, you want to scram? They're like, yep, you bet. And they just, they both popped right up and just went right in the hallway.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't think, make sex sounds during actual sex. I'm the silent assassin.
Will you keep your mask on? Make sure.
It's a Nixon mask. Real treat for the wife. Oh. You know, I want to make sure that I mention I got to see the Starling last night, and I was very happy that you get to play all these different notes now. Not that you were banned from doing that before, but you have created the space where you can do that. I felt the same thing about the Bob Ross documentary, which really I think is remarkable. And I've been telling everybody watch the Bob Ross documentary. But
I think people were, they're like, I think beforehand they were like, please don't ruin Bob Ross for us. I was like, no, it's not a hit piece. It's not.
It's a really lovely documentary. And I
thank you.
What I came away from in this between, because you've got all this work out there right now, the Bob Ross documentary. And you've got the Starling, you know, Nine Perfect Strangers. Is it nine or seven?
Nine.
I always like to shave two off of.
There were 12, but I can't talk about it.
But you've gotten to the point where I can't put you in a pigeonhole. And I think that's a fantastic place to be in.
Oh, thank you for that. And I feel.
And I have no really influence. So don't be too grateful for my compliment. Hey, Conan says I'm really going places.
Uh-huh. Hey, guys. Hey, Hollywood Boulevard. Have you heard the news? Q-Nonan says.
Q-Nonan.
I still can't say it right. I mean, I'm still pretty shocked that I work regularly. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ben and I often look at each other and we're like, are you kidding? Like, the fact that we're always waiting for like the knock on the door where it's like, oh, okay, we just figured this out. Get out. Like, we'd be like, cool. Can we grab a bag?
Yeah.
We can't. Okay. Cool. That makes sense. Like, literally, I think if that happened, we'd be like, we were waiting for this. So the fact that now it's like, I don't, because I really loved, I love doing plays and I just love all the storytelling. And I don't think it all has to be one or the other. It's like, it's odd when you do a comedy and there's pathos in it. And sometimes it really throws people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've had people just be like, well, I don't know why you have to have like a dramatic moment. I was like, well, the characters, in order to be funny, you've got to fall down. Then you get to watch them get up. You have to fall to get up. And if you want to watch somebody get up, they have to fall pretty hard. So you have to show that. And they're like, but it's a comedy. But I'm like, yeah, but Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is like a perfect movie.
Yes.
That in terms of endearment, my God, it's, I cry. It's such a heartbreaking thing. There's such funny moments in there. I'm like, I feel so lucky that I get to do both.
Like in the Starling, you've got these people, you, Chris O'Dowd, you know, Tim Oliphant.
Kevin Klein. Just
Kevin, Jesus.
I was like.
Yeah, Kevin Klein, who are all, have all the comedy chops in the world, okay? And then they can use that. They can also not use that because you're dealing with some heavy stuff. But you're also, it's not an either or. And I thought that was true of the Bob Ross documentary. I really encourage people to check it out because I came away from it still loving Bob Ross more than ever because I reappreciate him. And there's nothing in the documentary that was revealed that made me think of him any less. He's just was a beautiful man. Yeah. But seeing some of the darkness around how he was treated by the business side of things was absolutely, it's such a compelling story.
Oh, I know. Well, it's funny. Ben, we both separately and together have always really loved, as I think, a strange grouping of people. They love Bob Ross. If it's as a soothing thing, as just, it's great to just watch him paint. I remember him since I was a